The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Good Old Days. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the January-February 2026 edition of Good Old Days magazine. And since Valentine's Day is this month, I do have some stories I want to share with you about Valentine's Day. And the first one, The Mysterious Valentine Kiss. And this is submitted by Audrey Korn. Donnie was the first boy to give me a kiss on Valentine's Day. As a matter of fact, Donnie was the first boy to give me a kiss on any day. Back in the early 1950s, Donnie and I were students in Miss Kelly's 7th grade classroom in Brooklyn, New York. Miss Kelly had taught young people for 19 years. Over time, she discovered that most 7th grade students felt that Valentine mailboxes were for kindergarten babies, not sophisticated 12-year-olds. "Raise your hand if you want a Valentine mailbox," Mrs. Kelly said. Two giggly girls, Patricia and Catherine, were the only ones who raised their hands. The result of the vote were clear. "We're still having a Valentine's Day party with music and refreshments," Miss Kelly said. Miss Kelly waited for the cheers to die down. Everyone wanted red Kool-Aid, pink frosted cupcakes, and big heart-shaped cookies to be provided by our class mothers, of course. If you would like to send Valentine's Day cards to your special friends, you can walk around during our party and drop off your cards on people's desk, Miss Kelly said. "I didn't expect my girlfriends to send me cards, but when I returned to my seat after lunch, a pink envelope was waiting for me. Who would send me a Valentine's Day card? I sat down at my desk and stared at the envelope. Maybe it had been mistakenly left on my desk. But no, my name was neatly printed across the front of the pink envelope. I picked up the envelope. It held more than a card. There was something lumpy inside. I shook the envelope. The lump moved around. Several classmates were watching me. "Go ahead. It won't bite," Sandra Collins said. Sandra sat at the desk right behind mine. By now, even our teacher, Miss Kelly, was watching. "Yeah, open it," several more voices urged. I was a shy, quiet 12-year-old, unaccustomed to so much attention. My fingers fumbled as I ripped open the pink envelope. Inside, I found a card with a cartoon of a girl and a boy. The boy was down on bended knee. In a bubble above his head were the words, "Begging you to be my Valentine." As for the mysterious lump inside the envelope, it turned out to be a silver-wrapped Hershey's chocolate kiss. I was astonished and curious. Who sent me the card and the kiss? Was it Miss Kelly? She had been the last person to leave the classroom at lunchtime, but why would Miss Kelly send me a kiss? Richard Gordon was another suspect. Richard usually rushed into the classroom just as the late bell rang. Today, Richard had been the first student back after lunch. Or how about my best friend, Millie? Millie was always urging me to flirt with boys. "How else will boys know that you are interested in them?" Millie would ask me. A surprisingly large number of my classmates stopped by my desk during our party. They all wanted to see my card. Maybe we 12-year-olds would have enjoyed a Valentine mailbox more than we cared to admit. There was one boy, however, who showed no interest in me or my card. Donnie ignored the entire hullabaloo. But guess what? 4 years later, Donnie worked up the courage to invite me to our high school's Valentine's Day dance. More than 6 decades have passed since Donnie and I were students in Miss Kelly's 7th grade class. But we remember every February on Valentine's Day, I take my seat at the breakfast table, and there it is. I open the pink envelope, I read the card, Then I peel off the shiny silver paper and pop the chocolate kiss into my mouth. "Thank you," I say. Eating chocolate before breakfast makes me feel like a kid again. I finish my candy kiss. Then my husband Donnie and I share a real kiss as we remember back to a long ago Valentine's Day with another pink envelope and another silver wrapped kiss. And after that, we eat our sensible hot oatmeal, we drink our grown-up hot coffee, and most importantly, we give thanks to the good Lord for the happy ending to a love story that started one February 14th back in the good old days. And the next story I have for you is submitted by Luann Myers, and it's titled, You Always Remember Your First Love. Why do some girls like bad boys? Yes, Ricky was a bad boy, and I fell hard the first time that I saw him. He was tall, dark, and handsome. He seemed older and far more worldly wise than I was. Ricky was a natural leader and was looked up to by others. It was the fall of 1955 when I met Ricky on our first day of kindergarten. I was a farm girl and hadn't been around very many kids my own age. Ricky was a town boy and knew lots of kids in the small town of Kinsley, Kansas. Our little school had six small classrooms with one teacher for each grade level, kindergarten through fourth grade. The principal taught fifth and sixth grades together. There was no preschool back then, so kindergarten was supposed to teach you everything you needed to know for a successful academic future. I'm sure we started with the basic ABCs and 1, 2, 3s. I don't really recall the lessons that our teacher, Mrs. Nichols, taught us, but I have vivid memories of the lessons I learned from Ricky. Each day after recess time, we came back into the classroom to find the lights turned off and the window shades pulled down. Each student had been instructed to bring a bath towel from home, and this was the time when the teacher told us to find a spot to lay out our towel and lie down for a 20-minute nap. Some children actually did fall asleep, but Ricky and I were not among them. He would watch to see where I placed my towel, and then he would get as close as possible to me. He would whisper to me about things that happened on the playground until our teacher would tell us to be quiet. It was during this rest time one day that bad boy Ricky taught me to whistle. Whistling was not part of the kindergarten curriculum, but I definitely wanted to learn how to do it. Ricky was an excellent whistler and quietly showed me the exact way to hold my mouth and use my breath to make a sound. I didn't make a loud sound because it was quiet time, but nevertheless, a sound came out that was like a soft tweet. I practiced at home, on the way to school, and on the playground until I perfected my whistle. Bad boy Ricky also taught me to blow bubbles with bubble gum. Of course, gum wasn't allowed in school, but Ricky didn't seem to care. It was the same scenario during our rest time. One day, he pulled two pieces of gum from his pocket and offered me one. This was another skill that he had acquired that I was eager to learn. We had to be very careful that our teacher didn't see us and that we didn't pop our gum too loudly. It took some practice, but soon I was adept at blowing bubbles. Like most kids, we loved recess time out in the big play yard. There wasn't a lot of playground equipment at our school, but there was plenty of room to run, and there were huge old oak trees around the perimeter for shade. The other girls and I loved to make playhouses among the gnarled roots of the biggest tree that grew in the corner of the yard. We used twigs, grass, leaves, and stones to imagine rooms and people at the base of that tree. Ricky and the other boys would play a chasing game with a ball until suddenly they weren't. That's when they would jump out from behind the tree and scatter the wonderful creations we girls had made. I knew bad boy Ricky was the instigator. Mrs. Nichols didn't want to hear us tattling about the boys, and I learned another lesson. What happens on the playground stays on the playground. I don't remember if Ricky gave me a Valentine that year, but I remember a special present he did give me. In our little Kansas town, it was a tradition to make and give May Day baskets on the first day of May. My mother had procured some sheets from an out-of-date wallpaper book, and my sister Barbara and I cut and pasted the sturdy paper to make multiple sweet little baskets to fill with candy. That morning, we left the house to secretly leave the baskets on our friends' and neighbors' front porches. I was surprised to find that someone had left a basket for me while we had been busy delivering to others. It had my name on it, but it didn't say who it was from. The basket was brimming over with lovely striped tulips. I had never seen anything like them. They were pink and purple and red with white and yellow stripes. My mother exclaimed over them, and then the telephone rang. It was Ricky's mother, and she wondered if we knew anything about her award-winning tulips. Bad boy Ricky got in quite a lot of trouble over that May Day basket. My mother decided Ricky wasn't a very good influence on her daughter. I learned that mother knows best, and that was the end of my kindergarten romance. The last Valentine story I want to share with you is submitted by Joe Palermo, and it's titled A Valentine for My Crush. In second grade, back in 1966 in Addison, Illinois, every holiday demanded a classroom party, and Valentine's Day was no exception. This required the purchase of a box of Valentine cards. It was important that there were enough for the entire class, and each set usually included one for the teacher. We pored over each card as we decided who would receive it. For me, this year would be different. I dutifully signed my cards and wrote out an envelope for each student. But I didn't put too much thought into the process, as my target was not included here. None of the cards in the store-bought set would be good enough for Judy. Judy was my first crush, and she miraculously liked me as well. I would hold doors open for her and even help her with her coat as she slipped her arms inside. I think I had been watching too many old movies. For our classroom party, we all helped decorate a large box with lace and hearts that would sit on the teacher's desk. When the party began, we each would walk up to the box one at a time as the teacher called our name. The idea was to deposit all our Valentines into the box. Our teacher would then distribute them to the students so we didn't have to hand them out ourselves. I'm guessing this was to avoid embarrassment of some kind. My mother purchased the box of Valentine cards for me to use. She probably grabbed a set at random. I was grateful she remembered, but then I begged her to take me to the store so I could buy a special card for Judy, as none of the run-of-the-mill cards in the set would do. After reading and deliberating over each one, I finally decided on an oversized card that I thought was perfect. I bought it with my own savings from my allowance and proudly took it home. I took my time and signed it with my best penmanship as if I would be graded. On the day of the party, I had all my signed cards in their envelopes, along with a special one I had picked out for Judy. Names were called out in alphabetical order, so it took a while to get to me. Nervously, I gathered up my cards and approached the box at the front of the room under the watchful gaze of my classmates. I managed to stuff the cards from the boxed set in, as they were all small and the same size. The problem came when I tried to insert the card for Judy. It was too big to fit into the slot on the box. Now I had to get the teacher involved. Mrs. A, my card won't fit in the box. That's a big card. Who is it for? Oh, it's for Judy. Here you go, honey. She handed the card directly to Judy, and my face turned about 5 shades of red. The only kid in the class with a face redder than mine was Judy. Today, Judy is all grown up and married to someone else, though it's been almost 60 years since that embarrassing Valentine's Day in second grade. That's one day neither she nor I will ever forget. Since we have also had some snow in the last few weeks, I thought it would be fun to read some snow-related stories. And the first one is titled Almost Caught by Lee Gunton. In the mid to late 1950s, there was always snow on the ground from late November through March in Euclid, Ohio. Euclid was situated on Lake Erie and was always blessed with an ample amount of snowball ammunition due to the lake effect. As 10 to 12-year-olds, we had no idea what the lake effect was, only that it ensured a winter of snowball battles. After supper, we would go outside to play, darkness having set in at least an hour earlier. We would stand between our house and the Suhar's house next door, which was only about 10 feet away. There, armed with freshly made snowballs, we would wait for cars to drive down Westport Avenue. There was a street light just opposite our house, which gave our target zone good lighting. We became very adept at arcing the snowball and leading the unsuspecting car just enough so that the snowball and the car would meet about 2 houses down the street in front of the Zusick's house. A perfect shot landed on the hood so the driver could see it, and a roof landing was deemed acceptable. Trunk landings were just no good, and of course, misses were totally unacceptable. Since the speed limit on our street was just 25 miles per hour, we weren't concerned that the driver would lose control of his car. We did have some concern about his possible anger. Occasionally, a driver would stop after hearing a thump on his hood or roof, but by then, he was 4 houses down the street, and he was 4 houses and had no idea who the culprits were or from where the snow bombs were originating. However, one night, my brother launched what we referred to as a perfect shot, hitting the hood dead center on a 1954 Ford. His 3 years in Little League had paid off. The driver stopped and backed all the way up to our house. This had never happened before. Maybe he got a glimpse of one of us in a throwing motion. At any rate, when he got out of his car, we launched our previously well-thought-out escape plan and took off through our backyard to Wilmore Avenue. We then calmly walked around the block back to our house. If the victim had still been there searching for us after our 10-minute stroll, we had a plan B in place. This plan called for us to separate and head back to Wilmore Avenue, taking the long way back home, which would add another 15 minutes to our stroll. Ample time for the victim to lose interest and continue on his way. In this case, however, the victim had given up his search and resumed his drive down Westport Avenue. We returned to our fort and filled the arsenal with fresh ammunition, patiently awaiting the next unsuspecting victim. And our next article is titled Sledding Down Perkin Hill by Sanda Ayers. I woke to snow this morning. There was about 2 inches covering everything, ground, rooftops, trees, and roadways, and it was beautiful. However, when I stepped outside and the blast of cold, crisp air hit my face, it didn't look so beautiful to me anymore. If I were still 10 years old, I would have been thrilled for 2 reasons. 1, there would have been no school, and 2, we would have gotten to play in the snow. But we didn't just play in the snow, we sledded down Perkin Hill. Perkin Hill was located in a small town just outside Cincinnati. It was a great place to grow up in the 1950s. I don't know why it was called Perkin Hill, but all the kids in the area knew to meet there at the first sign of snow. It was steep, and we thought it was as big as the hills we saw on television that all the Olympians skied down. We hurried with breakfast and got dressed so we would be the first ones to go down the hill on the new snow. I don't know why we wanted to be first, because as the day went on, the hill would get packed down and become a sheet of ice. Then we could really fly down the hill. We didn't have any fancy sleds or toboggans. Oh no, we used whatever we could find. Cardboard boxes, a lid off an old washer, even a car hood. But the best one of all was a door off an old refrigerator. The refrigerator door had a piece that curled up in front to put your feet on, and we could get two or three kids on it at one time. But no matter how we started down the hill, we always ended up spinning around and going down backward. One day, some boys came dragging an old satellite dish up to the hill. I'm not talking about the small ones you see on people's houses today. This one was 10 to 20 feet across and looked like something from outer space. It took all of us to get it up the hill, and after we got to the top, we all piled onto it and away we went. At first, it was smooth sailing, but as the satellite dish picked up speed, it started to spin like a top. We were losing passengers like crazy as it spun around. By the time we got to the bottom of the hill, there were bodies all the way down the hill and only one kid left on the dish. We didn't care. We thought it was great. It was our own tilt-a-whirl, like the ride at the country fair. We eagerly dragged the satellite dish back up the hill for the next run. One day after the Winter Olympics had been on television, Chucky Barker came to Perkin Hill carrying 2x4 boards, a rope, and 2 mop handles. He had seen downhill skiing on TV, and he knew he could do it. We all watched as he tied the boards to his feet, and with a mop handle in each hand, he stood up and immediately fell over. But this didn't stop him. All day long, he kept trying to make it down the hill in one run without falling over. By the end of the day, he was getting pretty good at it. He was no Olympian, but he was the next best thing. He was famous among us as the kid who skied down Perkin Hill on 2x4s. Today's kids must have the best and newest sled and safety gear, including helmets, goggles, mouthpiece, shin guards, elbow pads, and the latest in outerwear. But the only saving graces for us were the 3 layers of clothing we wore, the plastic bread bags, and old socks we used for gloves to keep our hands dry and warm, and the 3 pairs of socks and old rubber boots with buckles that we wore on our feet to fend off frostbite. We played on Perkin Hill all day long. Only when the sun started setting did we head for home. We were cold, tired, and hungry, but we were dreaming of the next snow day we could conquer Perkin Hill again. Those were good times and good memories. I wonder if kids today would appreciate the ingenuity it took for us to sled down Perkin Hill. From Q&A on Your Mind, readers were asked, what dance fad did you really enjoy? And here are some of the responses. My favorite dance was the twist. I learned it from my friends and from TV. A friend of mine and I won a twist contest when we were teenagers. School dances were great. I don't remember ever not dancing when I had the chance. Of course, I'm 75 years old now, and those memories are golden. And this was by Yvonne Rangel. My first dance was the polka. My Slavic family on my mother's side all danced. I learned cha-cha from my aunt and the twist, mashed potato, stroll, and bop, all from watching American Bandstand in the 1950s after school. And this was by Cheryl Hadley. My fondest memories of the 1950s are my ability to dance any dance. Dancing came naturally to me and still does, even in my seasoned years of life. Of course, the jitterbug, which is called swing now, was my favorite. My brother, who was 2 years older than me, was taught to dance by my daddy, who was quite the dancer in his younger years. My brother was able to swing me all around, up and down, crossways, over his head, etc. So we took it to higher levels. We started dancing together when I was a sixth grader and he was in eighth grade, and we continued all through school. We won a lot of dance contests together. Life was so innocent during the 1950s, and it made life so enjoyable, especially being able to dance. And this was Carol Lee Maxwell. And last, my first school dance was at the end of eighth grade in 1973. The school was having a 1950s themed sock hop in the gym, and my first boyfriend, Bruce, invited me to go with him. My parents grew up in the 50s, so my dad taught me how to do the stroll, the mashed potato, and the Bristol stomp. I wore my mom's classic black sweater and quilted skirt. The dance ended with the song Good Night, Sweetheart, and at the end, I received my first kiss. I have never forgotten it. And this is by Bessie Gay Hash. Next, I want to share a poem by Emily Dickinson. Hope is the thing with feathers. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. Now I want to see if you can name these classic dishes. This iconic one-bite appetizer featured bacon wrapped around a water chestnut and chicken liver skewered together on a toothpick. Do you remember what that was called? Rumaki. Now, how about this popular salad was made with whipped cream, marshmallows, mandarin oranges, pineapple, and coconut? Do you remember the name? Ambrosia salad. Here is a famous quote by Aristotle. To appreciate the beauty of a snowflake, it is necessary to stand out in the cold. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time, and I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.